I wish I could pull it off. I wish I could pull it off. You give off an air of sagacity and wisdom, which I think is really nice.
If I let it grow, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then it's, well, I should really do something with it, but it's just a mess. So I just cut it off and it just repeats the cycle.
Your wife's happy?
She always claims long is fine because long is soft and short is prickly. I don't know if she always says she doesn't mind it long. I don't know what in terms of preference she has, but she doesn't like it being all prickly like it is short. So it's
it's
prickly for a week or so, and then it gets softer and softer, and just and pretty soon it's like a airbag around my chin.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I'm really excited for the conversation today. These things have been rumbling around in my head and very few people to talk about them with, right? So I grew up in the Midwest, in Milwaukee, and in a Catholic family, went to Catholic schools, a very kind of pale Midwestern form of Catholicism that I think resonated in some ways that I'm still dealing with, but in other ways kind of fell flat, and was, you know, very much an overachiever, went to a very elite academic Catholic Jesuit high school that was supremely helpful academically. I'm not so much sure that it was a healthy place in other ways, but very helpful academically and very rigorous. And I remember senior year, as I was about to embark on this secular education, I was in a world religions class and I said something out loud and the priest who was teaching the class pointed at me and said, "If you believe that, then you are an agnostic." Right?
Wow. And
much to my parents' chagrin, I'm not sure I shared that specific story with them, but certainly they weren't pleased that I came out of my Catholic education, you know, kind of agnostic and leaning secular, right? And so went to a very elite private liberal arts college out here in Southern California. Never left, was a student of the humanities, despite the fact that I had a math and science bent. I was rebelling against my mom who wanted me to become a doctor. And I was like, I love to read, I love to write, I want to be an English major, right? And
all so, this money into education.
All right.
And he chooses poverty. Oh, you Jesuit.
Well, not only that, not only did I choose poverty, but I came out an agnostic, right? All this money into a Catholic education, right? So the other thing I'll say is my family growing up, you know, was not functioning in a great way. And so I didn't see the faith being lived out in my family in a way that resonated. Now, that's not to say that my parents aren't good people. They were trying, they were dealing with their own stuff. And certainly, as opposed to many of my secular peers in Los Angeles, I know many, many people of faith who I admire and look up to and you know, want to emulate. So I never really, I mean, amongst my secular peers, I was the guy who was, despite the fact that I was leading agnostic, I was the guy who would kind of defend religion and be a little bit contrarian in that regard. So what happened is I was not ready, though, to be an adult after college. And I went through a very, very difficult period of time where I was, despite being an overachiever, you know, kind of destined for success, I was really, truly floundering, especially after a brief taste of success and doing quite well in my early 20s, I got derailed from that. And so I was really floundering in my work life. And in addition, I very much wanted to have a family. I so much wanted to be in a committed marriage with a family for a lot of different reasons. And that was not happening for me. I was, you know, I didn't have the appropriate relationship with my own sexuality. I didn't present myself strong in a strong, attractive way to women. I was getting into relationships with extraordinarily attractive, interesting people, but in a way I was picking them because they kind of, they kind of filled some perceived gap in myself rather than being a vehicle for something greater. So I was really, really struggling. And in the midst of the floundering in the career, I cast about for meaning and for something that I could latch on to. So I was very interested in how the brain worked. And I went back to school, did all of this science and math, and got ready to go get a PhD in cognitive science, cognitive neuroscience, and was fascinated by all these questions and learned so much about how the brain works and how what we think we're doing at any given point is really skimming the surface of what's really going on. And often what we articulate as our reasons for doing something is not, anyway, it gave me some doubt about, you know, easy answers about how we work as human beings. Eventually I decided, you know, I love these questions, but I don't want to be approaching this from an academic point of view. I don't want to be buried in the basement of a public university building doing these tiny little experiments on, you know, where we're controlling for everything and we're trying to figure out, you know, I didn't want to do that. I went down the rabbit hole of evolutionary psychology for a while, and really there, you know, I really that stuff really resonated with me, right? This and the central insight there being that, you know, we are evolved creatures, that we come into the world with an endowment of all sorts of things, and that we were evolved to work, to be successful in one type of environment. And the environment that we live in right now is very, very different than that environment. And so it's not a good fit. And that to me held a lot of explanatory power, right? It revealed a lot of things to me about myself and gave me further questions about the kind of broad, kind of the traditional approach, the secular approach, right? The non-scientific, the approach of the humanities, right? There are some flaws in how the orthodoxy of the humanities have evolved in our society. Anyway, so I really struggled, so I'm going through, casting about through these intellectual things. I went through a 10-year period of trying to write screenplays and learning about, you know, learning about Joseph Campbell and trying to tell stories, and you know, that's another lens on human psychology, right? So that was, I learned so much about myself during that period of time, but had very little success. Had a little bit of success, made a little bit of money doing it, but not in the way that made me happy. And so really, in all this time, I'm going through failed relationship after failed relationship. And then about 10 years ago, almost exactly 10 years ago, I had kind of gotten myself in a good place. I had sort of, you know, made it, despite the fact that my career was kind of going a little bit better, and I had sort of oriented myself in a good way. And I had gone through that pattern, that misery, deliverance, gratitude. I had come out on the other side of that somehow with no help. Maybe my Catholic upbringing was in there somewhere, but no overt reference to Christ, no overt reference to the church. I just sort of made it to a better place where I felt less insecure. And I felt that perhaps having a family and selecting someone to be with might be about being of service rather than about me, right? And so anyway, so I was in a bar and a pretty girl walked in, and I went down, my friend kind of kicked me, and I went over and I sat down and asked her if I could sit with her. And we're now married. She turned out to be a practicing Christian, the daughter of a Protestant minister. Her mom planted a church here in LA, kind of an emergent church. Although out of one of the mainline, I still don't understand. Partly your podcast has been helping me process my processing of the variations of American Protestantism.
Yeah.
But anyway, so she, you know, she's, you know, a practicing Christian, very committed. You know, her mom is the daughter of a Baptist minister who founded a very, very successful church in Denver, Colorado. And so, and I was just kind of open to it. Like I didn't, at that point, you know, I was not, I was just open. I didn't have a lot of the prejudices in me. I certainly didn't lean that way myself, but I didn't have a lot of the prejudices in me that a lot of my peers would have walked away from that encounter, right? Whereas I kind of leaned into it, it felt right. And so we started going to church and I, you know, one of the turning points is that I took communion when I went to her mom's church, I took communion and that was an important step. So my life just started getting on track. We got married, we started having kids, we bought a house. And so everything started to go well and my life, you know, just kind of got back on track in a really cool way. And I sort of discovered Jordan Peterson on the back end of all of that, right? At the back end of all of that. And the other thing that was going on is we started searching after that, after her mom's church kind of dissolved, we started searching for a church and we weren't going to Catholic churches. We were going to Protestant churches and it was very, very interesting to me. I had no concept of American Protestantism. Simone is very drawn, like she was drawn to all sorts of different types of churches. And so we went to very, very different types, you know, mainline suburban churches, you know, these emergent churches that I imagine were fairly Mark Driscoll-y, right?
Yeah,
in
yeah,
LA yeah. here. I think, and we only went once or twice because they didn't really resonate with me or yeah. with her after yeah. a while. So anyway, so then Peterson comes along and, you know, I discovered him like you did through Dreher, right? And I started listening to that biblical series, which is just like, holy cow, like what an intellectual achievement. And it had such a huge influence on me because he was integrating these different intellectual fields that I had a fair bit of background in and doing it in an extraordinary way. And so that happened. And then I discovered Girard through Dreher as well. And I went down this Girard because Peterson's, you know, that whole biblical series, I really want Peterson to do the New Testament at some point because it's really about the Old Testament so far. And Girard, I went down that rabbit hole. And I remember, Paul, I was out with one of my best friends, my cousin, who's a completely secular person, although he also was raised Catholic. And I was telling him about Girard and I literally teared up. Like we're in a bar and I'm having a couple drinks and I'm tearing up describing the ideas of René Girard. I was like, what the heck is that about? And I think I know what it's about. It's a, well, you know, upon further reflection, it didn't take a lot. It's like, it's unifying. He unifies different spheres of my head in a really cool way. And so anyway, I've just been processing all of that as in the midst of having kids and, you know, my kids are starting to go to school. We have our daughter just started at a Catholic school, but a very unusual Catholic school, much more Orthodox, much more almost evangelical.
Interesting.
Yeah. Reminds me in some ways more of the Protestant people that I've met in the last 10 years. And so I've just been processing this and, you know, when I found Peterson, I considered myself a practicing Christian, although that's still uncomfortable for me, very uncomfortable. And I struggle, especially with the statement of faith, right? As you would expect a secular person to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
That Peugeot conversation with Peterson really resonated with me because I just found myself identifying with Jordan in his struggles in his struggles to, you know, and I found myself really admiring and wanting to be more like Peugeot. But I see all of my own shortcomings in Peterson, and not just my shortcomings. I see some of my, I mean, he's such a gifted person. I'm a small fraction of his intellect, but he approaches things in the same way. He comes out of the same traditions, secular traditions of knowledge that I come out of.
Yep.
So I just kind of, I found myself very much identifying. And so I've just been, when I was eager to talk to you about, we can take this wherever though.
It's so interesting. I love your story. It's so cool.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me. I think my parents are baffled. Like, here we give them this very We give you this mild form of Catholicism that you rebel against. And then you come back like married to an evangelical, you know, Protestant, and you've got your kid in this very unusual Catholic school that is nothing like the Catholic schools we sent you to. But you gave them
grandchildren. I mean, that's a strong point. You know,
yeah, they come around. They I don't think it gave them grandchildren. It gave them a daughter-in-law who loves them and who wants them in our lives. You know,
yeah, so yeah, those are no small things for your parents. they're willing to forgive a lot of other stuff for the sake of.
They're not complaining too much. They even came with us to our we've been attending an Anglican church, and they even came, which was a big step for them. They came and visited. But I still struggle with the statement of faith, and I struggle with it both on a personal level, like but I also struggle with it plays out in churches in a way that I don't like, right? That makes me feel very uncomfortable, that I think sometimes hurts those congregations and it hurts the church in a way. But I see the value in it. I've been actually trying to write something about the statement of faith, and I'm a little stuck in it because I'm trying to get, like, could there be a version of Christianity in which the statement of faith is de-emphasized, or that is more like Judaism, which is about practice and stories, sacred stories and practice, and not about these statements of what we think happened, right? And I don't know, I'm not really satisfied with that, and I've had a hard time finishing the piece because I don't know exactly where I'm going with it, and I'm still processing it. I can't finish it until I know what I'm trying to say. But I'm curious, like, so the Aaron Rodgers thing is a great example, right? The Aaron Rodgers, like, saved and the unsaved, right? Yeah. And you see that play out. The statement of faith, it seems to me, is used often in an anti-Girardian way, right? It's used in a way to emphasize difference, right? And to say we're the good and they're the bad. And it also the thing that Peterson was, the Peterson lectures were so compelling, partly because with priests and ministers, I always feel like they're trying to get me over that line. Right? You know? And he wasn't trying to get me over any line, right? He wasn't trying to get me over any line. He was just trying to get me think about this stuff. And there was an exploratory nature to that. And you felt like you were accepting the call to adventure with Peterson, right?
Yeah.
In a way that, you know, and I still, you know, with, you know, having my kids in a Catholic school, I'm resistant to this idea that there's an answer that is provided by an external entity, right? And it comes down from on high, and we're supposed to accept that answer. And I see the value in that as well, but I want my kids, and this is where the rubber meets the road. Like, what legacy am I trying to leave with my kids?
Yeah.
I don't know. I still really struggle with it. And I think it's one reason why Peterson's lectures were so popular and resonated so much, is that it was this adventure and he was going on it with you.
Yep.
You were trying to piece it. You were trying to figure it out with him.
Yep.
And I wish I got more. I brought up Jordan Peterson to my pastor, and he, great guy. He's so smart. He would have lots of things to say, but he thinks, he's been told, that Jordan Peterson is a bigot, And so he doesn't want to go there.
Right.
Anyway, it resonated a lot with your descriptions of how when people who follow you on YouTube show up at your church, like, you're not going to get that same thing. And what I want to imagine is a Christianity where you can hold both sets of people, right? The yeah. people like this meaning crisis, all of these meaning crisis people like me that can be in church with these people who have a simpler belief system. And, you know, because I think there's a lot of value in that, right? Not everybody is going to go learn cognitive science and evolutionary psychology and try to be a screenwriter for 10 years and then come around in the end.
We hope not.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know how food will get grown or the lights will stay on, but
yeah, I wouldn't recommend it. I wouldn't recommend it. Although it worked out well in the end for me.
You can have a limited subset of people that take that path.
Yeah, exactly. So how do you envision a version of Christianity that encompasses both sets of those people, right? Like, or is it just going to have to be like, people like me are just going to have to be a little bit uncomfortable, and which I am in church. I squirm like Peugeot described Peterson squirming in church. I squirm a little bit, and I've kind of come to terms with that. Yeah. But I wonder if there's a way for me to not squirm.
Well, part of it gets down to the phrasing of the question, is there going to be a version of Christianity? Because then you have to ask yourself, well, what exactly am I looking for? Am I looking for a body of knowledge? Am I looking for a practice? Am I looking for a community?
Yeah.
Because the tricky part, of course, is the community.
Yeah.
Because not only do people have to cohere to achieve a goal, and you can cohere to achieve a goal if it's a reactive or reactionary goal. We're against this. And you can cohere a lot of people against something. Mm-hmm. But the question is, can we cohere a constructive people around something that's fundamentally constructive? And, you know, I was reading that book, Reformations, that I often wind up reading church history books that some of people in my Reformed camp don't like. And mm-hmm. Reformations is one of those books. And I think partly because it had a strong, I don't know the background of the author, but it was very favorable towards the Catholic tradition in many ways. And that was really helpful to me because I learned a lot about what the Protestant Reformation forced the Catholic Church mm-hmm. to address. Mm-hmm. And part of what happens in the Council of Trent is it's pretty clear that a whole group of historical events, not the least of which was the Columbian Exchange and what happened after the Europeans discovered North America and they were able to basically link up the world, and all of those things came. You know, there's just so many elements with the Protestant Reformation, you know, the Enlightenment, Galileo. There's just so many elements that came together in a fairly short amount of time to rip apart a consensus that had developed, that basically had been put together over 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. And part of what comes of that is that the Protestant Reformation and Protestant confessionalism in some ways grabs at exactly what you're talking about in order to at least achieve imperfectly among a group of people some degree of agreement that mm-hmm. could allow them to try to sustain a community. Mm-hmm. Now,
you do that somewhat through the confessions? Is that...
Confessionality is exactly what we believe.
Yeah, exactly. We believe.
Yep. Now, that's not completely alien, obviously, to church tradition. You can't read the Athanasian Creed and not get a strong sense of it. But what was, you know, you very much get a sense in medieval Catholicism that there are all sorts of implicit agreements that sort of cohere around ritual, the Mass, you know, the institution that mm-hmm. that's sort of very imperfectly with tons of conflict, of course, because, you know, contrary to people who say, well, you know, religion caused everything. Well, they had wars between Catholics, you know, many years before they had wars between Protestants and Catholics. So, you know, all those armies in Europe weren't there, you know, not doing anything. Now, warfare did change dramatically eventually, but so there's a lot going on. But basically, you had sort of this rough consensus with Catholicism that couldn't hold, and it couldn't hold up to the significant changes that were happening, you know, in places like Germany and mm-hmm. Switzerland, the Netherlands, you know, France and Spain sort of withhold, but you know, the Spanish solutions, which would get played out in Latin America, were horribly corrupt in some ways. I almost get the sense that France has tried other things, but that then begets the French Revolution,
right?
Which, you know, and even today, France, you know, there's, you know, when you look at how England and Germany and the America, you know, and the United States are dealing with globalization as opposed to France, you know, some of that pressure cooker, you know, let's avoid the Protestant Reformation. Well, they sort of reap the whirlwind. So there's tons going on, way more than any of us can sort out.
Yeah.
Intellectually, I suspect.
Yeah.
So now, you know, your plea is not at all unlike, in some ways, John Vervaeke's plea, Jordan Peterson's plea. You know, you'd almost get the sense that with Jordan's act as if that he could, you know, if we could have, and there's some of this within Peugeot, if we could have a Christianity that we finally more act out than talk about, that we engage with symbolically. But I don't know that people can do that and actually cohere well. You know, one right. of the interesting, I don't know how much looking around you did in your Protestant journey, but Anabaptism in many ways, whereas, so they're like Mennonites, the Amish,
you
know, whereas sort of the majority Protestants, the magisterial Protestants take the route of sort of a verbal literalism and rationality is sort mm-hmm. of how they constructed theirs. Anabaptism sort of attempted a literalistic behaviorism where we're not going to worry so much about all of this theology. We're going to emphasize doing exactly what we see Jesus do in the Gospels and mm-hmm. loving our enemies. And of course, they were persecuted by Catholics and magisterial Protestants. And so, you know, there's another tradition that in some ways de-emphasizes all of the confessionalities.
Right.
And then, of course, then in the Protestant history, so many of these things get practiced out, especially in the United States, because, you know, no creed but Christ. There's just all these different permutations are tried again and again and again in all sorts of different ways. And I think, you know, when I listen to your story and we look at Peterson, this is the continuation of this process because, you know, and because the new atheists finally failed. They couldn't they were too blind to exactly how much they inherited from Christendom. They just simply assumed the morality and acted as if they could reconstruct it, you know, with pure rationality, and that's just not convincing.
Well, it has a flatness to it that fails. You know, there's a little video online of Sam Harris destroying Christianity, right?
Yeah.
You know, he compares a serial killer in America who converts on his deathbed and, you know, is blessed with eternal life versus some 5-year-old in India who never gets exposure to the gospel and, you know, is condemned to eternal damnation. And, you know, I hear that and I'm like, oh my gosh, Sam, like just step back, right? like, just take one step back and think about, like, if we go down the route of determining, like, thinking that we can determine the good folks and the bad folks from here, whereas the idea that a serial killer could convert, right? Of course, that's very unlikely. And, but the idea that the serial killer could convert appropriately sees human beings as full of potential, right? And it assigns all of the past to the past, because the past is dead. Like, economics knows that the past is the past, like dead weight, right? Like dead costs, right? Like, it sees human beings as full of potential. And that's just a much better principle to build your society on, rather than this idea that there's the good and the bad, and if we look closely enough, we're going to be able to tell, and we can determine, right? The serial killer is the bad. And, you know, of course it fails when you look at that particular example, but in the big picture, there's just a flatness to that view that I think, if you're not, you know, there's a certain scientific person who that is attracted to, that flatness. And I don't think it stands up very well in the real world.
Yeah. I think what we're going to see develop is another turn of the screw of Protestantism.
Right.
But this time it isn't going to be anti-Catholic, which most Protestant history has been.
Right.
And now we've sort of got the Orthodox around more than ever, yep, in the Americas to be able to contribute to this. And so a lot of the inclinations that you saw in the early emergent movement,
mm-hmm,
which sort of got lost because the early emergent movement sort of split between the young, restless, and reformed and the mainline. And mm-hmm, so they sort of sped up the Protestant Reformation really quick.
Right.
And I think we're going to see a desiring of something different. And I think for this reason, I mean, when I was in Australia, a good friend of mine, the guy who actually brought me to Australia to do his little conference, you know, he had been he was raised dispensational. He had gone charismatic, and now he's worshiping in very traditional Anglican, mm-hmm, and loving it.
Yeah. But,
so this little old Anglican church there, and you know, they're not exactly flourishing. And I tell the pastor, I says, from where you're sitting in Australia, which is in the middle of Hillsong land, you might not believe this, but in a lot of ways, if culture moves from California to Australia, Anglicanism in some circles is the new hotness. And he always says, I ain't seeing it. I said, yeah, but be patient, because in some ways the Anglicans with what their tortured story through the English Reformation produced was probably in many ways a little bit closer to this, okay, you know, what on earth are we going to do with this? But Anglicanism itself is just such a large sack. So you've got, you know, the 39 articles of the Young, Restless, and Reformed, and many of those Reformed Baptists are actually in some ways Anglicans.
Right.
You know, they're sort of Neo-Puritans who have embraced infant baptism. So it's a weird wedding between American evangelicalism and Puritans, which really isn't very strange, because Puritans are at the base of American evangelicals. So there's all this stuff going on, but your sensitivities are very much right. It's just that to actually congeal and cohere a working community that has all of the elements figured out enough to actually work in real life, it hasn't come together yet.
Yeah.
But you see the pieces out there. And again, I know that many who listen to me have gone to Orthodoxy and are really enjoying it. But I do suspect that after, you know, they either they're going to change Orthodoxy in America sufficiently that new immigrants will come over and say, this isn't what we sent to America. Or I think it'll be and actually, and some who have been in orthodoxy for a while will say, are we going to see sort of a American slash Anglican slash orthodoxy develop that is sort of an American, you know, so if the Anglicans were the, you know, Protestant Reformation and the Roman Catholics sort of working out some of their differences. And again, there's a long strain of anti-Catholicism in Orthodoxy, in Anglicanism, of course, historically. Mm-hmm. So are we going to see something like that emerge? But it's, you know, you've got the blessing of being a super early adopter, I suspect. And there's no church that has been able to cohere. And so probably, Protestants, the heart of Protestantism is remaking a church to fit the times.
Mm-hmm.
And there's strength and weakness in that. And I think we're going to see that happen. Now, of course, some people might look at me and say, well, Vander Clay, you seem to know a lot of this stuff. You seem to be kind of, why aren't you? Because then I think they come to Living Stones thinking, oh, we're going to see the prototype.
Yeah. And
no, you're not going to see that. you're going to see basically an evangelical racial reconciliation church in its last days. That's what you're going to see here. Now, will something else emerge from Living Stones? Or will Living Stones die and out of estuary things will start to cohere? I don't know.
But you're right, though. It's all about the coherence. And the thing that I left out of my story is that I don't belong very easily, right? And I have resisted belonging so hard and for both good and bad reasons and for some reasons that aren't even available to me. And you know, right now with a family, it's very easy to belong to a family. Like I belong to my family. I no longer wonder where I sit, what the most important thing is. I know what the most important thing is, but I want my children to be able to belong to something greater than their family.
Yes.
And academically I could probably get my kids into these elite colleges. They could belong to that, but I really do not feel comfortable with that for a variety of reasons. And I want them to be able to belong to a church. And I want, and in order to teach them that, I feel like I need to belong. And this belonging has centered on the statement of faith in many ways. And I've sort of made my peace with it. Like I'm a little uncomfortable. I think more people, if they gave more thought, would probably be more uncomfortable with the statement of faith. Like if you really gave it a lot of thought, it's like Jordan Peterson says, like this is a big thing to believe, right? And it has certain implications. And you know, there are parts of me that just believe it whole cloth, right? Like, and those are very deep parts of me. And so I can, and because I see the value in the story and I've intellectually seen the value of the story, I'm trying to wed the two parts of my brain, the disbelieving part and the intellectual part that needs to understand why, with the part that just believes. And I can't get away from that. I don't want to get away from it. I don't want to get away from it. I want my, anyway, but the belonging is really key. And I do feel like we're just at this inflection point. I don't know what comes next, but the problem is like the church that we belong to here, this Anglican church, it's a church plant from a couple of Fuller grads. It's not doing that. Like it's doing pretty well, but they had to leave because we couldn't pay their salary. Right. And that's a problem, right? And it was a crisis for me because I'm like, we're one of the families with a little bit more means, but, and we weren't, you know, and I was very devastated. They were close to our family. Their kids are close to our kids. And I wasn't, I'm one of, you know, we're one of the 5 or 10 families that could have like ponied up there. And for a variety of reasons, I didn't know that they needed it. And my own hesitation and my own, you know, it's just not a part of my thinking to do that. But then I felt really bad when the consequences hit me and it affected our, you know, it's going to affect our community. You know, it's not clear where this community is going to go, whether it's going to persist. It may very well, or Maybe not. I don't know. It's from my mother-in-law. My mother-in-law says you're going to start a church in Highland Park. You're going to have a hard time sustaining it financially because the people who are going to be drawn to you are struggling in their careers. They're trying to make it in Hollywood. They're paying rent that's off the charts. You're paying rent for the church that's off the charts. The financials are tough to make work, but how do my kids, how do we find that? I just don't know how that all works, because that coherence and that instinct to pay into the community, both with time and money, I'm not sure we're there yet, right? Like, I feel like that coherence, right? I feel like something's going to emerge to encourage that. I hope it does. And I feel like I've got to get there too, anyway.
No, you're exactly right. And so my background in church planting, all of those dynamics you're talking about. And so what's happening in Protestant church planting, and I suspect, even though you're not going to, the language sounds odd, Orthodox church planting, mm-hmm. Anglican church planting, Roman Catholic, traditional rites church planting, is everybody's bumping into these questions.
Yep.
And part of why, as you described your story, part of why you have the dissatisfaction with a sort of confessionalism. Now, again, confessionalism was this movement that happens in the wake of the Reformation, because Luther thinks you just take Erasmus and you read them and you just see there's corruption here. So if we just take the Bible plus reason, everyone will agree. And in some ways, the kernel of an idea is at the heart of Protestantism, and it keeps getting disproven because they're not agreeing. But the vision is so glorious and so powerful, it keeps us going in that direction. That's at the heart of confessionalism, because confessionalism then says, well, we're not going to agree, but we will cohere together and team up and work together along these agreements, and they're propositional now. And they are, and then of course, when you get into the modernist fundamentalist thing, now you have the difficulty of, well, what if they don't cohere or correspond with physicality in the past? So you have all the historical questions. And now with cognitive science, you have the questions of, aren't all these confessions just simply post hoc?
Right.
So we need a deeper foundation. And okay, so now liturgy, ritual, symbolism, but you're not going to simply turn a blind eye to the challenges of modernity and say, okay, we're going to construct. So this morning I was listening to Peugeot and Richard talk about universal history. And I love that. But as a Protestant, I listen to it and say, yeah, but are you really going, you can't go back and unsee what the Enlightenment saw.
Right.
You're going to have to deal with it.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to, and the community's going to have to deal with it. And so that's what we're trying, sort of like the integral people. I mean, we sort of need to kind of level up, but now integrating the Enlightenment with the things that the Enlightenment threw away, and we're like, no, we need to keep those, but how can we do it? And your children are growing up fast, and it's like, this isn't a church I want to see 50 years from now. I want this church today.
Oh, exactly.
But exactly. Not everybody sees like you see. And again, you're unfortunately, well, yeah, your parents gave you a great education. You're right there on the bleeding edge. Lucky for you, nobody else is around you yet, but stuff is coming, I suspect.
No, I think so.
But yeah. Part of the problem is that I think culture is moving so quickly. There's a sense in which if culture moves too quickly for regular people, for, a bell curve group of people to sort of keep up with it,
well,
then you wind up just with incoherence.
Fragmentation. Just
right.
Infinite fragmentation. I listened to that. I don't watch your stuff on YouTube, so you won't see me show up in the stats, but I listened to that full 3-hour thing on the marriage equality. And I just can't tell you how much I identified with that. I have very strong instincts for marriage equality, right? Very, very strong. But when you start playing this out, I mean, the congregation that we belong to is a part of a denomination, right, that is a split off because of that. And the pastors never talk about marriage equality. Like, I don't know what their positions are in marriage equality, precisely because if they were to be overt about that, the congregation as it exists would split, because yep. both they're binary, right? And yep. I'm actually not binary. Like I but not being binary, like, it intellectually it's helpful and it might be right to be able to see both sides, but in terms of sustaining communities, there might be a right answer.
Yes. Yes. Right? And it would seem reasonable that there's a right answer.
And yeah, and I, right, you're this idea of holding up the one man, one woman, you know, ideal as a as an archetype, right? That resonates with me, right? I mean, it that ideal that was in my brain carried me through so much pain and suffering and like just messiness in my life. Like, I see people who have this, that seems to be going rather well for them. I want that. And I don't know what you anchor on if you don't anchor on that anymore. Your description of that really resonated with me. And I mean, it makes me uncomfortable because that's it's pushing me in directions that are.
What do you say to your gay friends?
Well, right.
And, exactly. And partly because I've got another video that I was going to release today and I kind of chickened out, but I might release it tomorrow. Or I get into some of this stuff again, because it's just that there are some other deep values in our culture that we're going to violate, and we don't want to do that. And we don't want to do that for some real reasons. And no, this is, there's a reason. I mean, again, Peugeot, it isn't arbitrary that it's at this point that we are hitting a crisis.
Yeah, I agree.
And what you're describing is exactly right. And I see this. So, you know, it's a dirty little secret among pastors in places like the coasts that are in denominations that aren't affirming, that this is something we can't talk about.
Yeah.
Because the integrity of our local church depends on sort of an avoidance of this. You can't sustain that long term.
No, you can't. You can't. And I asked my mother-in-law, I said, you know, based on after your video, I was like, have you ever married, right? Have you married, you know, which, and, you know, even she was like, although she knows me well enough that we could kind of talk through, right, the problems of that a little bit, right? And the difficulties of that question for her, right? but I don't know where you go. It's fascinating. I spent, you know, I have some libertarian leanings politically. And so I've always been a bit of a contrarian. And I used to think, oh, you know, these folks are the enlightened, you know, smart people. They have a few, if they knew more about economics and about systems thinking, they would, you know, they'd understand that these certain policies that they're advocating might not be the best thing. But they're the good enlightened people. And I've just, in recent months and years, I've just started to think, whoa, there are some very deep things about what it means to be a person that those people are missing. And I do want to say, there, like, we talk about secularism, there's a split. And I saw this, like, the evolutionary psychology folks were despised. And some of these people, right, there's a guy named Robert Trivers, who was contributing massive amounts of knowledge to the thinking about how the psychology of human beings and how evolution might have contributed to that. He was married to, you know, a Black woman, considers himself a leftist. He was pilloried in the, I don't know what this is, 70s and 80s. This was after I discovered it, but the left, the humanities left, despised this idea that human beings come into the world endowed with, you know, they really want to believe in nurture. And they despise this idea that you come into the world endowed with something. And I believe that there is much more coherence between a biological and evolutionary view of the world and Christianity and even the other religions, right? Like they're, you know, the gender identity thing, like when science tells you something is innate and all the world religions agree that that isn't something to be messed with, like discard that at your own peril, right?
Yeah.
Very, very careful.
Yeah.
And I don't see a lot. And anyway, the humanities, I saw it in my English classes, right? There was just a lack of, there were certain assumptions that were just embedded and we didn't read, you know, I came out of an elite college with an English literature degree and I never read Paradise Lost. I still haven't read Paradise Lost. That makes no sense.
No, you're right on. You're right on. And this social construct, I mean, you'd see it with the Brett Weinstein. I mean, Brett Weinstein is a poster child of this, of course. You know, yep. Brett and Heather are out there trying to, yep. You know, Brett's yep. trying to hold it together, yep. But you know, it's difficult. It's really difficult, partly because at some point you're going to have to let religion back in the door.
Yeah.
That's where Peterson, I think, you know, was really much more on the frontier because he saw it and he was crazy enough to speak his mind.
Yeah.
And you know, he's this weird combination of, you know, by virtue of his upbringing and everything, he you know, I had a conversation with Ron Dart early on my first one, and Ron Dart thought Peterson was more Erasmus. I said, no, Peterson is Luther, because the more you push the guy, you know, that deep angst, the inner conflict that's just going to explode out of him. That's Luther, and that's Peterson. And now Luther, you know, Luther isn't necessarily, boy, Luther's history and legacy is very complicated. And Peterson's will be too, but Luther sort of broke things open so that others could walk through. And I think that's kind of what Peterson did too.
No, I agree. I mean, I agree. I also wonder about Girard, Girard to me is powerful in a similar way about the New Testament that I've experienced Peterson as on the Old Testament. And I still don't understand how I could come out of 12 years of Catholic school and not know who René Girard is. Like those, or to come out of a, you know, like those are very important ideas. And I can see how there's lots of folks who wouldn't take to them, but those seem like very important ideas to contend with. And they offer an opportunity for this integration, right? That I think so many people need right now. I want more people to go through that. It's hard to convince people to go read René Girard or even to watch those biblical lectures, right? There's a natural resistance, but I really want a lot of folks to do that. I want to be able to talk to more people who have that, and I want them to push back on me. And I don't know. I just want to be able to have better conversations.
Yeah. Well, hopefully. So I have a son now who's living in LA, and I'm always visiting Vindonk down in the down in the Chino, Ontario area. And I get down there. I'll probably be getting down to LA on a much more regular basis. And I hope to, you know, we should do lunch sometime if I'm down there.
Oh, I'd love to.
And, cause I'd love to consider this, continue this conversation, because people look at me and they're like, well, Vander Clay, no, I can't solve this. You know, this is something a community won't solve it by writing books. Community will manifest, progress by its being and in its practice. And that's, you know, fundamental to Christianity, which the Protestant Reformation really struggled with. Fundamental to Christianity is not a list of beliefs.
Right.
Christianity is a life.
Right.
It's a way of living and being.
Yep.
And, you know, I understand why Protestantism took the shape it did. And Catholicism then reacted to it. But your instincts are correct in that the next church hasn't been born yet. But again, when I say that, the Catholics and the Orthodox, no, that's Protestant. And people keep telling me, Vanderclay, when are you going to join the Catholics and the Orthodox? It's like, I think I'm too Protestant because I want something that brings the whole family together. And I don't know if the Orthodox and the Roman Catholics are going to bury the hatchet. They're closer, but, and
probably not.
And I think, I don't think you can just dismiss the Protestant Reformation and the Enlightenment as a bunch of bad ideas that we're going to do away with. Not if you want to keep your computer and your internet. And the Orthodox seem very eager about podcasts and YouTube channels. So a little dubious, you're going to, if you shut all that stuff down and go back to your pretty cathedrals and monasteries, well, then I'll never know about you. So these are the conflicts that we're working through. So,
yeah. And I think, the flourishing of all those different flavors of Protestantism, right? There's a lot of risk in that. There's a lot of Mark Driscoll type risk in that, but there's also a little bit, there's room there for authenticity and cultural adaptation that I've seen, right? Has some, there's real potential there and there's something really wonderful about that. So
it's an evolutionary process, and the Protestant Reformation always has been. And no matter how much denial the Catholics and the Orthodox have about that, when I look at them, I say, Jonathan Peugeot is the way that Jonathan Peugeot is like a church father is because he's different from them. Right. He is addressing now.
Yep.
And he is manifesting something from the church fathers now, but put Jonathan Peugeot into the 7th or 8th century.
Yep.
So this is the path that we're on. So
yep.
This was a delight, and you really are going to let me share this, aren't you? Please.
Of course.
I completely respect people when they say to me, and many have said, I really can't share this because of such reason. That's totally fine. But
It's important for me to be authentic in the world. And these aren't things I spend a lot of time talking for my job in front of people. And like, I'm not normally talking so honestly or intimately. But I think it's important to be as much that way as you can.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Tim. And I very much, when I get down to Southern California again and have some time, if we do a meetup or an estuary group or something, I'd very much love to see you and continue this.
Yeah, and there's a chance I'll be in Sacramento. So let's do it.
Okay, sounds good. Right. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Paul.
Bye-bye.